Hello, Brooklyn. How you doing? Where you going? We cannot come to. And if I can, I'm gonna be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. However you going, baby, you going? Just take me, cause I'm so taken. Hello, Nets fans. How you doing? This is the Russell and Fro podcast. Russell here, Fro there. I am Brett, the man bun, Garofalo, although I do have my hair in a ponytail right now, so I've been lying to you, fam. Accompanied by Carl, the talent, Jackson. Lots to talk about. Katie's picking on the T-Wolves. Alize Johnson got paid. Exciting things going on in Nets world, despite our loss to the 76ers. But I'd love to know, and so would the fans. Carl, how are you?
Brett, I was going to start this off by saying how disappointed I was because this game has been circled on my calendar for weeks now, knowing that it was going to be this pivotal Eastern Conference showdown. And then the way that injuries broke with the Minnesota game moving in the back-to-back, like it really was a letdown until we discovered a, much like the Kings comeback of 2019, discovered that the secret sauce was, in fact, Alize, Nick Claxton, Bruce Brown, Landry Shamet, running point guard, and, of course, LaFrench Bricket on the floor to end the game. That was I haven't felt as good about a Nets loss all season, Brett.
I wish I could disagree with you on that. I'm going to reuse a pun that I meant to use in our last podcast. I think that this season, the Nets were sick and Sean Marks and Joe Tsai were in the lab trying to find a way to get them better. And they scientifically engineered a Claxtonation for the Nets. And ever since then, I don't feel like we have been out of a game. And like you just said, there's nothing more fun than watching Bruce Brown, Alize Johnson, Alize and Nick Claxton out there running around, missing shots, getting putbacks, getting 12 offensive rebounds in a possession. It was putting a little pressure on Ben Simmons at the line, watching him frown, grimace, miss free throws. Joel Embiid complaining to the refs against the Nets. I don't even want to say B squad, maybe even our C squad out there. Landry Shamet running the point. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, like, there's not much to take away from it in terms of what it means for the playoffs or what it means looking forward. But I do think that there's something to take away from it in the fact that, Doc Rivers put his starters back in to close that game out, and Steve Nash didn't. Joel Embiid limped off the floor like, you know, he just got run over by a taxi cab. Alize Johnson didn't. So, I do think that there is something to, if there's a team to be, as much as Joel Embiid wants to be the wrestling heel in all of this, and he does a fantastic job of it. And listen, I have the utmost respect in the world for him as a player, and I have the utmost respect for him as an entertainer. And I absolutely hate him. And I hate that I hate him because I know that that's exactly what he wants.
He's in your head, rent free. He's in your head.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He's posting up in there. His Andre Drummond is not the only head that he has waterfront real estate on. That's like a water for brain joke. It's a dead joke. It's not a very good one. But anyway, I'm not even sure it is one actually. Point being, I liked hitting him in the mouth a little bit at the end there, and it gave me a little bit more excitement kind of going into a playoff series because I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and that is exactly what we want to talk about. Not exclusively the Sixers, but I think basically after last pod, we talked about the deadline acquisitions, and we know that the Nets have a ton of what has been termed optionality in the front court, a lot of different ways that they can go here. We got a pretty deep rotation. So we want to look at, across the board with the top contenders in the Eastern Conference, and we're only going to focus on the Eastern Conference for today. How do the Nets stack up and how do they want to play? And I think the best place to start for that is actually with the Nets themselves, Brett, because, I think two pieces of NBA media that I have consumed this week, and I say that because one is a podcast and one is a video, are Matt Brooks' fantastic YouTube video on the Nets front court depth, where he deep dived into specifically LaMarcus Aldridge, Blake Griffin, and Nick Claxton, which you should if you're listening to this podcast and you have not watched that, you should stop listening to this podcast and watch that, unless you're driving a vehicle, in which case you should not watch a YouTube video while doing that because it is dangerous.
And then come back and listen to the next hour and a half of this podcast, which I'm sure is the amount of time remaining on it.
we don't wrap it up under an hour and 20. But point being, you should watch that. He goes into, like, I think one of the striking things about this team in this rotation is just how different each of those players is. So he does a great job cataloging that. And then the second one, which is kind of the framing device that I want to use to start this off, was an episode of Real GM Radio, which is Danny LaRue's podcast, where he had Dan Devine from The Ringer on. And the question, you know, Danny said, basically, he's like, I think if the playoffs started today, and he felt like this was likely going to be the case when the playoffs did start, he said, I would pick the Nets to come out of the East. Probably win the finals. But I would also say that I have absolutely no idea like what this team is or wants to be. And I think the question that they raised, which I hadn't really gotten as fine a point on, is like, do we know right now what Steve Nash even wants? I mean, we know that he wants to experiment. He's going to experiment throughout the rest of the season, which is the right thing to do. But do we know, like, does he have a lean right now on like what he wants this team to be, what he wants this rotation to look like? And sort of what is, you can think of it in two ways, like what is his sort of opening move to start a playoff series? And then when he feels like, you know, somebody's hit back at him and it's, you know, not necessarily react to what the other team has done in terms of the chess game, but it's like the chips are down. What are you going to roll with? You know, what does he want to do at that point? Does that make sense as a question, Brett?
It does. There's a lot to talk through there, and I'll just make one comment on Joel Embiid. There's no better way to make it seem like you weren't taking a game seriously than limping off the floor and also saying, you know, maybe I wasn't at my best tonight. I know they came back, they made it close, but I'm a little bit banged up, just came back from an injury, still limping around. Sixers fans, everybody calm down. I'm okay, I'm limping, I'll be fine in the playoffs. Just an incredible bit of showmanship for him. And there's another underlying concept that I want to frame the conversation around, going back to what the heck does Steve Nash want to do with the Nets when the going gets tough and the tough gets going in the playoffs, and what does he believe are the best iteration of this Nets team is going to look like, whether it's a five-man lineup or our full rotation. I think it's going to be very difficult to try to pick out of this regular season, both data-wise and eye test wise, what the best iteration of the Nets is. And that's for a couple of reasons. I listened to one of Ben Taylor's podcasts, the last two episodes, and he was thinking that this regular season is going to be the hardest outside of maybe the 50 game lockout season in the late 90s to take regular season signals and extrapolate them into future performance in the playoffs because of the shortened offseason, the number of injuries, the weird scheduling, COVID protocols, you name it. There's just so many weird variables going around that I don't think we can necessarily look at the lineups the Nets have played, the plus minus of those lineups, the lineups their opponents have played, and say, hey, we can definitively tell what the Nets' best lineup is, what their best combination of players is, how many minutes each bench player should play, blah, 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 and that's going to be optimal. So we're really taking guesses, and that's why I think Steve Nash is treating this regular season like his own personal coloring book, except he's looking at the lines, and he's just painting outside the lines. I just don't think it matters. So, I mean, if...
Very Jean-Michel Basquiat of him, right?
Yeah, it is. It's very representative of Brooklyn's finest and this season and the illustrious pair of socks that you wear every time the Nets get a win. So I can guarantee.
I do. The socks did not work for me tonight. I almost considered not wearing them because I like knew that tonight was not really a fair test. So the socks are 0-2 against the Memphis Grizzlies and then this game. But otherwise, they're, I think, undefeated. So.
Cool. Hey, well, listen, in a Bucks series, Celtics series, Heat, Hawks, Pacers, Knicks, bust out the Sox against the 76ers? I don't know. Maybe we see. Maybe we try them for game one, see how they go. And then we'll go from there.
My voodoo doesn't work on Memphis, Brett, and I think we all know why. So So yeah, so I totally agree with you, and I totally agree with sort of the Ben Taylor idea of like it's really difficult to pick out sort of anything certainly statistically significant. I have found sort of the best that I can do is just kind of, you know, you open the lineup data, you look at it, you look at what guys are doing, and you just sort of like let it wash over you, and then you just kind of like draw your own conclusions, or you make up sort of what you think might work. And I think there is some interesting stuff that we can determine and see, you know, just by looking at sort of what we think each player is doing, and then what, like how we think that might work in theory. So there is some interesting things to have there. So let's start out by just running through the, I'm going to go five guys that the Nets can have in their two front court spots. I'm not going to include Bruce Brown in this, not because I don't include Bruce Brown, but I'm just sort of holding him outside of it somewhat for this, because I think he'll get more of his playing time at like an actual guard spot. And I wouldn't necessarily consider him, like, particularly as we get into sort of moves and counter moves with other teams, like I wouldn't necessarily consider him a front court player in that regard. So just sliding through these kind of alphabetically, also because it bumps LaMarcus Aldridge to the top, which is somebody we didn't really talk about last time, and going through alphabetically by last name, of course, to be clear on my sort there. So LaMarcus Aldridge, you've got the best all-around offensive game, I think, and this is guys that could fit in. Basically, I'm going to talk about LaMarcus, Claxton, Jeff Green, Blake Griffin, and DeAndre Jordan. So anybody that could play kind of five or four, not going to include KD, not going to include, you know, smaller guys that might slide in there. LaMarcus Aldridge, best all-around offensive game. He is really the only player on the team that brings kind of like a post-game that creates sort of an inside-out game. Scoring 1.1 points per possession on post-ups, which is 80th percentile in the league. But he also has the pick and pop ability, which gives him the ability to stretch the floor. So I think when you look at the inside out stuff, one thing that I noticed, if you look at stats with him on the floor and off the floor with the Nets, like one of the biggest areas of increase is in assists per or percentage of baskets assisted. So, you know, I think that's a little bit, you know, him passing out of double teams, obviously working from a small sample size. With the pick and pop, I think you see a guy like Bruce Brown, who is able to do some of his work out of the dunker spot, and cut and sort of maximize that space that's created when you're drawing a backline defender up to deal with LaMarcus Aldridge. And, you know, a representative stat of that is that the Nets have a plus 21 net rating in the 65 minutes that LaMarcus and Bruce share on the floor. They're minus four in the minutes that LaMarcus plays without Bruce. So that's a pretty big swing right there. Obviously, again, small sample size. I guess doesn't include the last two games, but LaMarcus hasn't played them. So whatever. Overall, with LaMarcus' team, slightly better offensively. They're slightly worse defensively. Uptick in offensive rebounding and uptick off in points off of assists, like I mentioned. The other thing, you know, I think overall that makes sense. I think he is probably the best all-around offensive player of this group and the worst probably all-around defensive player of this group. I think he's slightly worse than DeAndre Jordan on the defensive end, particularly because, like, as we saw tonight, I think DeAndre has more value in certain types of matchups, and those are the same types of matchups that LaMarcus would theoretically be best at, but he's just not as good as DeAndre on that side of the floor. Although I would say the gap on the defensive side is probably narrower than the gap on the offensive side. And then the last thing I'll say about LaMarcus Aldridge, and I do think that this is kind of important as you start talking about players and closing games, he is an 87.2% free throw shooter on the season. Which is a big deal, particularly when you contrast him with the next guy on our list, Nick Claxton, who's only shooting 50% from the line. Claxton, obviously best all-around defender, certainly the best at switching, as we talked about last time. I'm not going to belabor it this time. I think on offense, he's got some, you know, big impactful skills in terms of his verticality, his vertical spacing, his roll gravity. He's a great lob finisher. He's a great rim runner. He puts pressure on the defense, sort of downward pressure on the defense that way in terms of running baseline to baseline. He's also able to handle the ball. So when he does get the ball at the top of the key, it's not quite like the same experience as like DeAndre Jordan, where people are standing 25 feet away from him and he refuses to dribble. Also had that thick coast-to-coast finish against Philly. So we've talked a ton about Claxton, best defender with offensive pluses, very athletic, big upticks in offensive rebounding recently as well. But, you know, so that's kind of that. Jeff Green, I think, has been so far the Nets sort of death lineup stand-in. He's been the guy that's gotten the call in the big in the bigger matchups all season. He, I think, is probably second best at switching on the defensive end. He's very adept at that and probably a bigger gap. I'd say there's a wider – I think Nick Claxton is significantly better doing that than Jeff Green is, and I think there's a wider gap between Jeff Green and whoever is third, and I'm not even sure who that is of this group than there is between those two. He's like a pretty solid offensive player all the way around, I would say, with two sort of plus-plus skills, one being his three-point shooting, which is huge. He's shot 41.5% on 3.4 attempts per game. That's numbers before tonight, including a 46.8% mark on wide-open threes. So that's a great plus skill to have in terms of stretching the floor. And his other plus skill is just absolutely cocking the hammer back and yamming it on dudes, which is awesome because he's 34 years old. He doesn't post up very much, but he's actually in the 99th percentile in terms of post-ups, 1.39 points per possession, which is insane.
Uncle Hefe.
He's done it very, very little. And so I think that it's a little bit of noise there. Also a good free throw shooter as well, 76% from the line. And then rounding out with Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan, I think Blake Griffin in a lot of ways has maybe the most well-defined role right now. And that's because it's sort of defined by his body. Like I think he's come in and been an excellent hustle and energy guy off the bench. We described his role as potentially being either a sort of tall, more positionally size appropriate Bruce Brown or a backup Jeff Green. And I think he's done both of those very well so far. He's been able to knock down open threes when they've come to him. He's, you know, been able to facilitate play, make off the short roll. He's been able to kind of cut and get into space. He's been able to finish when he gets close to the rim. He's done a little bit of the Jeff Green sort of back down post up type play. He's just been great hustle, energy, grit, all that kind of stuff. I think if he played more than 12 minutes a game or so, like I don't think he can. So it kind of naturally like I think, you know, I don't think he'll ever exceed that in terms of what he brings to the table on this team. But I also think as, you know, backup roles diminish as we get into the playoffs, like he will still maintain his and other guys will drop below him and not play. Would be my guess. And then last on the list is DeAndre Jordan, who obviously was out of the rotation for several games once LaMarcus started until yesterday and today. I thought tonight he played pretty fantastically against Joel Embiid. Just really, really solid defense. I mean, he had one or two mistakes, and I thought got jobbed on some cheapy fouls too as well. But you and I joked earlier this season that like the Nets should just actually bring back Jason Collins to set hard screens and commit hard fouls. And that's what DeAndre was doing tonight. So, obviously putting Embiid on the line is not necessarily a winning proposition because he shoots really well from there. But at the same time, you know, DeAndre was able to, I think, just be physical with him. You saw him kind of pushing him into a lot of turnarounds and things like that. Embiid obviously got his, like, don't get me wrong, but I think was doing so in a way that was inefficient enough that I think the Nets would certainly live with it. So I think his role will be like, I don't know what role he has outside of two matchups, but those two matchups are Philly and Milwaukee. So, you know, if there's two matchups you could pick, those would be the top two. Is that fair rundown overall? You have any other thoughts you want to add there on those guys before we start talking about combinations and how they work?
Listen, I only retained about 20% of what you said, but all I heard was if the Nets play Blake Griffin 12 minutes a game, DeAndre Jordan once every 12 games, and fill in the rest of those minutes in games with Clax, Green, and LaMarcus Aldridge, we're going to win a championship. So I'm good to go. I don't know if you are. We can probably move on to our next topic.
Makes sense. It's a good primer. I kind of blacked out in the middle there. So I had written a lot of notes.
Well, I was going to say, I think we're thinking about it in the same way. If I am understanding what you're saying correctly, what Steve Nash is trying to do is take the big four. It's not a big three. It's a big four. It's Joe Harris plus the big three. Then take any one of the five that you mentioned and figure out which one of those guys makes sense to close out a game based on the matchup. And I think that's really what Steve Nash is trying to do and figure out during the regular season which one of those players is optimal against what type of lineup, what type of player, what type of pace, what type of situations can I trust them in, whether it's little things that are going to matter at the end of games like inbounding, free throw shooting. Do teams react to these guys when they're on the three-point line? What type of gravity do they have rolling towards the rim when the going gets tough? I think those little things are the things that Steve Nash is experimenting and evaluating to figure out who should and who shouldn't be playing at the end of games. And a wrinkle that I'm also interested to see is we'll know when we're taking a playoff series super seriously based on what starting lineup the Nets throw out there. Because if we start a series with DeAndre against anybody that's not the 76ers with DeAndre Jordan out there, you can tell that the Nets are like, yeah, let's just see how this game goes. And, if we need to pull DeAndre out, that's fine. And we don't mind starting the game, maybe down 10 or 15. We feel like we can come back against this team. So I think those are going to be some very interesting wrinkles to watch, but I am very glad that Jeff Green is getting his due amongst all of the big names that we now have in this front court rotation. So is that kind of along the lines of what you were thinking?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'll just ask the question sort of point blank, like, what do you give me what you think his sort of, I guess here's the hypothetical, right? First playoff series. So it's against either let's say the Nets are first or second. So it's against the 7 or an 8 seed. So you're not going to react to matchups based on that. You're Steve Nash. What are you putting out there to start the game? And then, and I guess let's just start with that.
Sure. So first playoff series, we don't necessarily care about what we think we're going to win the series, no matter who we start. And it's more about catering to the team, catering to egos, and probably getting some of these guys, some marquee minutes in the playoffs. I think that we're going to see either LaMarcus Aldridge or DeAndre Jordan start in that first playoff series, regardless of who it is. And that's because those are the two biggest names that haven't been completely decimated by injury that we have to throw out there. I would have said Blake Griffin, but like you said, he's much better suited as a hustle guy off the bench. If he's playing more than 12 minutes a night, then something has gone horribly wrong for the Nets, and he's fallen into that niche quite well. So that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. I can talk about closing lineups in a second, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, I think I'll go through a sort of standard rotation that I think that the Nets will throw out, which will include a closer. But then I think we can talk about like, okay, chips are down, it's game 7. Like how are they going to close the game? Because I think that's almost more interesting. But
that's the most important question. Yeah, because I think the question that you asked is more about, you know, who are we catering to? How are we like stroking these guys' egos? Who's going to be out there listed as the starter? Because that matters to some folks.
Yeah, I would guess that you'll see the kind of the starting lineup that we've seen or anticipated since LaMarcus Aldridge joined will start the first playoff series. So you will see Kyrie Irving, James Harden, Kevin Durant, Joe Harris, LaMarcus Aldridge. I'm fairly confident that will be your first starting lineup that you'll see. I think that Aldridge will kind of play, like if you remember the last few games before he joined the team when DeAndre Jordan was still starting and sort of starting both halves, but Nick Claxton was kind of coming in and then taking over with the starters to kind of close both halves. I would guess that that's what you'll see. I think you'll see that kind of starting five with Claxton and Blake Griffin as sort of the bench, quote unquote, like bench unit front court, Jeff Green kind of jumping in for the in-between minutes, and then either Jeff Green or Claxton closing games. That would be my guess.
That's also how I feel. And it'll be extremely interesting to see if Claxton Green are moved into that starting lineup, depending on how hard the Nets get punched in the mouth by our opponents. Does that ever happen? Or is it an inevitability, and how soon does it happen? And when that switch is made, do we ever go back for the rest of the playoffs? Maybe the next series. But I think that is, you know how they have that meme where like the older brother is sitting back playing video games, and then all of a sudden something happens and the dude like leans forward in his chair and starts clicking on the controller a lot harder. That's the moment that we're talking about here. When does Steve Nash realize, oh crap, my little brother's getting a lot better at Mario Kart. I better actually dig into this game and pick up some green shells and start sliding around the turn. returns. Like that's really what we're waiting for here. And that's, I think you're right. That is going to be signified by moving one of Clax or Green into that starting lineup. I would be extremely surprised unless the bench unit was rolling or the Nets were up big if one of those two weren't also finishing games for the Nets, unless we are in a situation where it's going to be a foul game and we need somebody to nail free throws. That's going to be either LaMarcus Aldridge or Jeff Green.
Yeah. So what do you feel like? So then I guess the tilt forward video game meme moment, it's game seven, let's say, of a series. No matchup considerations. It's just, this is like a hypothetical. Steve Nash wakes up from a dream and he's like, put this lineup in, like, you know, the season depends on it. Who is that five man unit to sort of to close a game?
To close a game, it's the big four and Jeff Green.
Which
is crazy. It's crazy to say that Jeff Green is in our game seven finals closing lineup, but I think that's it. I think that you can trust.
I thought we would disagree on that, but I think it 100% is. Yeah.
No, I don't. Sure. I mean, so let me just go through this too, because I know I started this by saying you can't trust regular season data from this season, but I did do some lineup analysis, playbyplaystats.com. Nets top eight lineups by minutes this season feature three of the big four. There have not been enough minutes of the big four playing together to really extrapolate anything out of that. Five out of eight of those, regardless of what combination of the big three or what combination of four, three of the big four plus whoever is, it could be DeAndre Jordan and Bruce Brown. It could be Reggie Perry and my Apple TV remote. It doesn't matter, right? So five out of eight of those lineups have a positive net rating. Three out of those eight are plus 24 and above. And then two of those plus 24 and above lineups feature DeAndre Jordan, which is insane because his individual plus minus in the season is a flat zero. So like, that means you can throw anybody out there with those big four and it's going to be a good lineup. But out of those that I mentioned, the best lineup is the big four plus Jeff Green at plus 35. So love Uncle Hefe. He's my guy at the end of games, unless for whatever reason his shot goes completely cold, but he's got that veteran presence. He's been around the league. He's got the close-knit ties with James Harden and Kevin Durant from the early days. He's the guy that I want out there. He's the guy that I also think that they trust the most.
The big floor, I think, is hilarious. I completely agree with you. I think that the defensive chemistry, especially with Harden, is super evident, and that's why, you know, Claxton's a better defender than him, and so there's merit, I think, to wanting to do that. But the defensive chemistry between Harden and Green is so great that, like, to me, I keep coming back to this, right? Which is, and this has been what I've thought through, like when we were bringing in Andre Roberson, or, you know, Iman Shumpert, or talking about, you know, getting a defensive, you know, stopper to play with him. Like, if you are going to commit to playing at least Durant, Irving, and Harden on the floor at a given time, like, you can bring in two great defenders to slot with him. And I'm not saying it won't make a difference. It'll obviously make a huge difference. But at some point, like, you should also be looking at ways that you can maximize the defensive output that those three guys are going to give you. And I think Jeff Green is a way to do that. I think he also provides enough of a matchup curveball to other teams. Like, if you think back to the Clippers game earlier this season at Barclays, where, you know, they, like, Tyronn Lue just took Serge Ibaka off the floor, particularly in the second half, because they just couldn't hang, you know, with Green, and Green was, you know, able to spread the floor so well, and he's athletic enough to put it on the deck. And, you know, between with him and Harris as well, like, you know, you can't just run them off the 3-point line the way that the Sixers were able to do today to Joe Harris, like, because, you know, they're able to put it on the floor and come in. And when you're playing five guys that are stretching the defense so far out to that, you know, amount, like, I think it becomes really, really difficult to play sort of a traditional rim protector center. So there's a little bit of a sort of force your hand matchup wise that way. And then I think it's just also the Steve Nash, Mike D'Antoni DNA. And that was another thing that I think Dan Devine brought up on that Real GM podcast, was like, let's not overthink this, guys. Like, this is this is Steve Nash, you know, growing up in Mike D'Antoni's system with Mike D'Antoni next to him on the bench, you know, this is like, they're going to like, when the chips are down, man, they're going to double down on offense. Like, don't get it twisted. Like, they're not going to try to hedge and like bring a defender in. Like, they're going to double down on offense. And I would say even furthermore, the guy to the other side of him on the bench is Jacques Vaughn. And Jacques Vaughn is there because of his connection with Sean Marks from the Spurs organization. And the Spurs organization is not a double down on offense organization, but the superpower, I would say, of the Spurs organization, which is definitely the thing that Sean Marks has brought to Brooklyn with him, is an absolute keen, laser-focused understanding and clear awareness of who you are. And I think that's what the Spurs have always done so well in terms of, you know, finding role players and finding guys. And part of that battle is knowing exactly what type of hole you're trying to plug these guys into. And I think that's what we've seen Sean Marks do so well through the Kenny Atkinson era, where, you know, they've been playing the style that they had wanted to play before they had the players to do it. Even if that meant Quincy Acey chucking threes from the corner when he wasn't good enough to make them. So I feel like this team, the thesis of this team, the superpower of this team is, we're going to just, you're not going to be able to guard us. And we are going to score on you at will, and you're not going to be able to do anything about it. And there's no amount of sort of diminishing returns or, you know, what about the defense that is going to prevent this team, I think, from going back to, this is what we do best. If we are going to win, we're going to win by blowing your fucking doors off, and you're going to score on the other end too, but you're not going to be able to score as fast as we are. So I 100% am on board with that. Sorry, I got a little ranty there, but that's how I feel. Jeff Green, pencil it in.
No, I love, and that's what this team does to us. We're sitting here ranting about Jeff Green, how excited we are to see him in our closing lineup in a potential game seven against one of the two Los Angeles teams or against the 76ers or the Bucks. And if that happens, not only am I going to have full confidence, I'm going to be freaking pumped because I love Jeff Green, and that is awesome. So we're going on rants about Jeff Green. I'm in. I'm all in on that.
So two other things. Just while we're here, just to cut you off and be a dick for a second, just because I'm really excited about Jeff Green. Two things. Number one, did you see, I do most of the tweeting from our account. I tweeted out a video of Jeff Green's daughters watching the game yesterday, presumably because it was a 4 p.m. game. So it was probably one of the only games that they were awake for, watching him on TV and just like pointing him out and just being absolutely adorable. Did you happen to see that at all?
I missed that, unfortunately.
Oh, I will send it to you. It's great. It's wholesome. It made me feel so wonderful inside. I loved it. Second of all, bigger question, is Jeff Green the most underappreciated dunker of all time ever?
Yeah, well, he might be one of the most underappreciated players of all time as well.
Incredible career for him, but like, yeah, everything he's done. Extraordinary.
I mean, think about the starting his career on a team that no longer exists, the amount of teams that he's played for.
The only two remaining Seattle Supersonics are on the Brooklyn Nets.
Yeah. So this really is a championship for Seattle if we win it too. I can get on board with that. That's some good juju for King Felix. Yeah.
It's for King Felix, baby.
Well, it's for, and then also Jeff Green had heart surgery too when he was traded to the Celtics. That year, like the dude has just been through the ringer, and he was one of the last players signed this offseason as well. The Nets waited a long time to pick up their guy, and we ended up picking up Jeff Green, and people were disappointed in that. Nobody was excited by the Jeff Green signing, and I think that one of the only reasons you and I were high on it is because we listened to the one of the Dunked On, or maybe it was Nate Duncan and Hollinger, or it was a Dunked On podcast where they said that's actually huge because that gives them a lot of versatility. And look where we are now. We're talking about Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, LaMarcus Aldridge being Jeff Green's competition to fill out that fifth and final slot in our closing lineup, and we're choosing Jeff Green over those guys. And oh, also, none of those guys that I just mentioned are our second best option, which is wild as well.
Is there a single person that was signed for the taxpayer mid-level or less that would have been a better pickup than Jeff Green? Throwing all these numerical questions out at you, knowing that you haven't done the research for it, because I did the research in my glass of whiskey that I just finished.
I am trying to remember.
I don't think
If we're talking about value to a particular team, like for example, if Jeff Green
specifically
is
for the Nets,
Yeah. Like if you're, it's the perfect role for him too. So that also can't be overstated. It's not like Jeff Green is the best player of all time. He's just an incredible fit for this team and this role, but that's awesome. And it just shows you how miscast that he's been. And sometimes those guys that can put up points on any given night and throw down thunderous dunks and look like they have the build to look like they could be one of the best players in the league get miscast. And when they don't perform in those roles, then they tend to get underrated or bumped around the league a little bit much. And he may have gotten overpaid based on that earlier in his career, but I'm glad he still got some left in the tank when we've really figured out how to best use him. Also, the other question is, who isn't Nick Claxton a better defender than? Because we were talking about, Claxton's probably a better defender than him. Like, are there 10 players in the league that we could pick out and say these guys are definitively better defenders than Nick Claxton? I'm throwing questions at you now that you haven't done research on, but you just got me thinking about that when you said that earlier.
Probably in terms of, I mean, I don't know.
Like Gobert and Anthony Davis are up there.
I mean, I think we could probably get to 10 if we tried real hard. The only reason being that I think so much of what he's good at, I mean, two things I think that skew things slightly with him. I mean, or three, right? One is he's, actually don't know how old he is. 21. He's not old. He's very young. You know, Jeff Green was probably at Georgetown when he was born. So that's like one thing. So a lot of it is potential. The other thing is like a lot of it is, you know, how good he is at guarding, on the perimeter for being a big man, is like off the charts incredible. But I do wonder if you had a more just sort of straight positional matchup, probably. Would be better. I'd say Gobert, Davis, Ben Simmons, probably, Drew Holiday. Like, I think you could probably get to 10 in terms of the overall completeness of the game. Cause I do think that over the last couple games, like teams are a little bit starting to figure out ways that they can, go at him and, you know, just not pull him into switches. But anyway, I digress. I can't name 10 off the top of my head.
Would you put Jared Allen above him?
I think that Jared Allen is a better defensive anchor. And if you were asking me to build a team, I would rather build a team defense around Jared Allen than Nick Claxton. If you took contract sort of out of the mix, that said, I think that Nick Claxton is a better fit for this Nets team right now defensively because they want to switch and he's better at that than Allen was, and they don't want to drop, you know, they don't want to play him in drop. So
I think that's fair. I think that's the thing that we just need to keep in mind when we're looking at all these players and falling in love with them. They play perfect roles for this particular Nets team. We do not know what they would look like on other teams. Jared Allen, we already know he's going to be good no matter what team he goes to. It doesn't mean Claxton would be bad on another team. He just wouldn't be, oh, wow, this is the missing piece we've been waiting for. It's like finding that last piece of a puzzle that happened to fall under the couch when you were putting together a 1,000-piece puzzle that had a bunch of cats on it.
Well, and that's sort of what I was saying is so incredible about him last week or last, whenever we last recorded, is just that, like, if you could have apportioned out the amount of skill level that he has, you would have done it exactly the way that he is, right? Like, it's kind of incredible because I don't think that that's like a normal skill set. But we're a little bit off the reservation here in terms of what we wanted to be talking about, which I guess is, like, you know, sort of similar to what this is. But so chips are down. I think we're both pretty clear on the Nets will probably go death lineup with Jeff Green. I kind of agree with that. I think that. That makes a ton of sense. Do we want to talk quickly about the opponents and what lineups they're trotting out, what we're worried about, the sort of counter moves that we think that the Nets are going to be forced to make here when we get into the playoffs?
I'd love to. Before that, what do you think would be our second best closing lineup? Like, would it be Clax? Or would you put LaMarcus Aldridge in there because of the free throw shooting and the offense?
Good question. So there's sort of two ways I could go with this. One would be a little bit to kind of hedge your question and say, not to be too like much of a Jeff Green stan here, but I do think there is probably a solid closing lineup where you play you don't have Harris on the floor and you play Green at the four, and it probably would have to be Claxton at that point at the five. So you get defense without sort of sacrificing some of the bulk underneath. I think there's other matchups where probably Big Four and DeAndre Jordan is a solid closing lineup. Big Four and Claxton. I'd probably say Big Four and Claxton is your best bet. And then Aldridge, I do really like Aldridge's offensive versatility. So the fact that you can kind of go from he presents a little bit of a matchup difficulty in the sense that you can't, like, they can play quote unquote small with Aldridge on the floor on offense and force you to bring, you know, your big outside to deal with him, but you kind of can't play small against him because he'll just go down to the post and eat you alive. So there's some interesting matchup stuff going on there. He's just so slow that I worry about it a little bit on the defensive end.
So I agree. I think that Clax plus the big fours are the second lineup that I would want out there. And the reason for that is I really think offensive rebounding at the end of games is incredibly important. And he gives us our best shot at getting those clutch offensive rebounds with his ability to slither around people, jump over guys. He's faster than everybody. He's never going to run out of energy because he's like 12 years old. So I really like that factor, that muck it up factor of Clax just running around trying to grab every loose ball out there. And I don't think we're going to have Bruce Brown out there in our closing lineup, so we're really going to lose that without somebody like him out there. But then like LaMarcus Aldridge, dude's 80, he's getting double teamed still. And if LaMarcus Aldridge is getting double teamed when we have Joe Harris, Kyrie Irving, James Harden, Kevin Durant, like, it's just not going to happen. So you're always going to have LaMarcus Aldridge one-on-one in the post. He's going to eat against anybody except the Marc Gasol, Joel Embiid. Like, that's going to be fun.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder a little bit, and I sort of felt this way with the Sixers series 2 years ago. Like, if you have somebody that can kind of eat in the post like that, maybe you just let them, because it's fair. Post scoring is just kind of inherently inefficient anyway. And if he's going to be flinging up, you know, turnaround jumpers where they're not going to get the offensive rebound, like that would be the adjustment that I would make if I was playing against this team with LaMarcus Aldridge. Is sort of like any LaMarcus post up is going to be a better, you know, unless I bring a double and he's kicking it out for a three, any LaMarcus post up is sort of going to be a better outcome for me than sort of what any of the other guys would do. So
that's fair. And that's probably something Nash is going to have to watch too. Like, hey guys, it's going to be your natural instinct to look at LaMarcus Aldridge in the post against a scarecrow or a bag of potato chips or some half eaten Doritos or whatever it is. Don't throw the ball to him. We need to run our normal offense. I think that's going to be tough to pull that whole, like, hey, get it to our guy in a great matchup type of mentality out of the team.
Yeah. But you know, it'll be interesting. I do think offensively it's very potent, just for the reason that I mentioned before in terms of like the inside out, because that really just adds a dimension, a different type of dimension than exists when you're playing like a DeAndre or a Claxton, where, you know, you might be able to, like, so when they play five out entirely with Jeff Green, I feel like the one thing about it is it's sort of stretching the offense as far as you can and then sort of finding seams within it to get to the basket that way. When you're playing with Claxton or DeAndre Jordan, it's like, now you've got the pick and roll game going. You can put pressure on the rim with kind of floaters and lobs, and particularly with Harden orchestrating that works so well. When you've got LaMarcus now, it's like you can toss the ball in and kick it out. And I think that adds a little bit more of a dimension, particularly for somebody like a Joe Harris or, you know, turning Kyrie, KD into the excellent spot up shooters that they are. I do wonder how that'll play with Harden, since we haven't really seen that. So that'll be interesting too.
Harden is such an equal opportunity guy, though. The one play I've been going back to since you started mentioning Jeff Green's ability to put it on the floor is the end of that Phoenix Suns game during the best comeback in the season, where Harden specifically sought out Jeff Green and forced him to be the ball handler in a pick and roll, and Jeff Green effectively ran it and scored in the clutch. Imagine if that's the play, and that the Nets are running, and Jeff Green takes somebody off the dribble and hits a layup in the clutch for us. Like, I'm just, man, the possibilities are so wild right now to see who are going to be the guys that step up. PJ Brown hitting a jump shot in Game 7 against the Cavs in the Eastern Conference semis in the year in 08 when the Celtics won the championship. There are going to be those little heroes that step up for us, and I think Jeff Green's going to have some big moments.
Yeah, it's such a fun team because, like, I've heard this analogy made on a couple different podcasts, kind of cross sport. One of like comparing it to a spread offense in college football, where sort of which I don't watch a ton of, but sort of the purpose of the spread offense in college football is just to get your offensive player the ball in space one on one with a defender, because the offensive player is almost always just going to be faster and more skilled than the defensive player in that scenario. Or if you think of it in terms of like the soccer concept of kind of playing with advantage, like getting a ball to a teammate in a scenario where they have the advantage on the person they're guarding. And with this Nets team, which I think just as a general sports concept, like applies to basketball a lot as well in terms of like setting up isolations and late game stuff. But with this team, like you're going to have that advantage almost every single time, because I mean, we saw Kyrie, you know, Simmons, who could be defensive player of the year, I think did a very good job on Kyrie at points during this game. And Kyrie was still able to get loose and go crazy. Kevin Durant can score against anybody and is possibly the most talented scorer of all time. James Harden is solving the defense like a fucking Rubik's Cube, like one of those like Rubik's Cube kids that's like, I'm making Rubik's Cubey hand motions on the Zoom here. You know, doing that every single time with the ball, and is going to have, you know, an advantage and can carry like two or three guys into an advantage by himself. And then you've got Joe Harris or Jeff Green, who as the fourth or fifth option, or LaMarcus Aldridge as the fourth or fifth option on a team, like are always going to have the advantage because they could be second or third option on most other teams. So it's pretty cool.
Man, it's wild. And you're right. On defense, you have to guess and react. So it doesn't matter how fast and how athletic you are, you're always going to be the disadvantage because you don't know what the offensive player is going to do. And we have people that can force the defense to guess and react versus having DeAndre Jordan at the free throw line and everybody looking at their Casio Baby G watches and just like tapping them, whatever they are. It doesn't matter. But anyway, and I will, as always, we have to put the caveat down there, barring that nobody gets injured, because that is a major looming shadow over all of the fun and excitement that is the 2021 Brooklyn Nets. But we all know that there's no reason to mention it more than once on the podcast. And you know, I think we can probably move on and talk about what some of the Nets opponents are going to look like, how they might try to counter the closing lineups that we're talking about, and ultimately who we're most scared of in the Eastern Conference when, like you started the pod off, when the chips are down and the Nets are trying their hardest, putting out their best strategies and saying, hey, this is it.
All right. So, we looked at five, but I think we're only going to talk about four teams.
Yeah.
Cause we didn't get far enough with Toronto, who I think is still sort of scary if they come out of the play-in as like a first round series or something. But, so we're going to look at, I'd say the East really breaks down as the big three, which are, you know, Brooklyn, Philly, and Milwaukee in some combination of a top tier sort of their own. Miami as like a really frisky four, and Boston as like probably a, you know, a five, I think. Just and not in terms of seeding, but just in terms of like concern level. So why don't we start with Boston, start from the bottom, work our way up. Brett, like what sort of closing lineup do you see the Celtics throwing out there? What concerns you about them? What matchup considerations would you make if you were Steve Nash?
The Celtics are such an interesting team. And first of all, shout out to the Hawks. I am very interested to see what they look like and how they perform come playoff time. And I hope we're not eating our words by not counting them in this top half of the Eastern Conference. But I'm also of the same vein that you are, that they're just not quite there, even though they're going to be really, 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 really fun to watch. And they're going to keep pace with anybody in the playoffs.
That would be a fun ass series. I mean, those games were very competitive when they played them. I think the one advantage the Nets would have in that scenario would be that's your Bruce Brown at center series, man. That is, you know, bring Bruce. I mean, maybe not at center, because maybe you play Claxton to hang with like Capella, but bringing Bruce Brown in and having him roll against Trae Young was like an absolute light bulb moment, I think, for the Nets this season. So I would expect plenty of that.
And they added offense. They added Lou Williams. I don't know what they're doing, but I'm on board. I love it. They're doubling down on who they believe they are and what their strengths are too. So more power to them.
The other move is, well, actually, I don't know whose move it is to make, but definitely think some extracurricular activities with Lou Williams and James Harden might be going on in the Atlanta games in particular, but you got to wear a mask.
That's like that old Nets playoff series.
Don't have to wear anything else.
The old Nets playoff series from good Lord. And where is that mask being worn? That's the question. The old Nets Bulls playoff series where they had one of the assistant coaches take Dennis Rodman out the night before one of the games. Who drinks who under the table? I don't know. Does Lou Will win that? Probably. I mean, Harden is definitely a partier, but Lou Will is like on another level. So that that could be the secret Nets kryptonite, especially if we're all, listen, especially if we're all waxed and vaxed by that time. I'm one of those things right now. Guess which one?
I am certainly not waxed. But let's talk about Boston.
Waxed, vaxed, and claxed. All right, yeah. Let's talk about the Celtics. So, if I had to guess their closing lineup, I think this one was a little bit easier than every team that we're going to talk about, with the exception of the 76ers. But for me, it's a fairly straightforward combination of your boy, Kemba, national championship, Walker, Marcus, illustrious teammate of Markel Brown, Smart, Jaylen Brown, Jaylen Nets pick Brown, Jason, traded for, leveraged the Nets pick to get him Tatum, and the Time Lord, Robert Williams. That's how I'm looking at it. Maybe they throw Tristan Thompson in there, depending on who the Nets decide to close the game with. Like, for example, if this is a LaMarcus Aldridge game, or for some crazy reason we have DeAndre Jordan out there, maybe you're throwing Tristan Thompson in there. Or if we've got Jeff Green out there and they think that their best bet is to throw Tristan Thompson out there and hope that he gets every single offensive rebound he could potentially gobble up, and he can somehow make his way back on the floor, and that's when they're doubling down, and I can see that. But I think they're going to go all switching, all athleticism, all offense, and throw those five guys out there.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's exactly the lineup that I had written down. I think defensively, like the thing about Boston that makes me sort of less worried is, so, I mean, I guess what does make me a little bit worried about Boston is just like they've been sort of discombobulated all year. Kemba's kind of coming back from injury and is looking a little bit stronger now. Tatum, I think, has been pretty public about coming back from COVID and how difficult that's been. Shouts to him using an inhaler. That makes me feel very cool.
53 points with an inhaler before the game. Like, that is wild.
You got that asthma. As a greeting card I saw somewhere. But anyway.
That's where the mask is. Got it. Okay.
Yeah, it just had a picture of an asthma inhaler and it said, "You got that asthma." I didn't buy it for my wife, but I thought about it. But she doesn't have asthma. I do. But anyway, long story short.
Opportunities.
Exactly. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, if they want to counter with Thompson, like, I think that plays into the Nets' hands, frankly, because it makes it much easier to play with LaMarcus Aldridge or DeAndre Jordan. And with Kemba out there, like, I think they kind of need Kemba in order for their offense to really work. And with him, and I, listen, I'm I mean, you alluded to it, like I will not slander Kemba Walker, but I do think that any defensive deficiencies that you worry about with Kyrie Irving, you don't worry about if he's guarding Kemba Walker. So to me, I just feel like it's a solid matchup. You know, Tatum going off or you know, Jaylen Brown going off, notwithstanding, you know, I think it's a matchup that that I'm not super worried about for the Nets. I don't know that you necessarily have to get too deep into your bag lineup wise if you're Steve Nash, with the exception of like if they do want to play Tristan Thompson and just muck things up. You know, I think you've got Aldridge there as a counter, and I think you've got DeAndre as there as a counter.
Yeah, I think so too. I think against the Celtics, we just have to make shots. I think we know exactly what they're going to throw at us. I don't think that Brad Stevens has as many wrinkles as he would like to switch up lineups, and it's about them keeping the game close enough that they can throw this lineup in there and hope that Tatum and Brown and Kemba create enough offense around Smart and Williams to keep pace with the Nets. And unfortunately, the Celtics just haven't looked that inspiring this season. But again, they had a deep playoff run last year. It was an incredibly short offseason. Jason Tatum got COVID. Kemba Walker was injured. Who knows? Maybe they do have a flip, a switch to flip. And that's something that we're all overlooking right now. And we get to the playoffs and they've just been trying to get through the regular season. All of a sudden they turn it on and they're taking the Nets to seven. So I'm not saying that I couldn't see it. And I don't want to discount them simply because of this weird, wacky, wild, condensed, short off season, regular season.
I think the Marcus Smart, Blake Griffin, and or Marcus Smart,
yes,
a Boston native Bruce Brown dust-ups are going to be pretty excellent in that
series. Let's go. Oh, man. The Blake Griffin face after he clearly threw an elbow that he was trying to make look inadvertent is going to be one of the best things to come out of a playoff series. He is our new Jared Dudley.
For sure. All right. So with that, why don't we move up the ladder to, I think, the consensus number four in the East right now in terms of scariness, the Miami Heat. Brett, how do you see the Miami Heat closing games? What lineup scares you and what adjustments would you make?
So this was the hardest one for me to figure out. Number one, I think it's pretty easy to say, oh, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the Oladipo injury? That makes this really tough. So Victor Oladipo, for those of you who don't know, injured his knee. The Heat believe that they're going to be able to get him back before the playoffs. How long before, we don't know, and it's still a possibility that he won't make it back. I'm going to operate under the assumption that he is going to be back and try to build my starting lineup around him being in there. I am always a big believer in the more ball handlers and shooters you can put out there, the better. So I'm throwing Goran Dragic in my starting lineup. I'm throwing Victor Oladipo out there. Jimmy Butler has to be out there. Bam Adebayo has to be out there. And that fourth spot is the most interesting spot to me. I do think that trying to sacrifice offense for defense against the Nets is going to be a death knell. So I think I would rather have Duncan Robinson out there to really stretch the floor, especially considering Bam has not quite figured out how to stretch from the free throw line to the 3-point line, and the offense runs through him. But I think you could probably make a case for slating a 85-year-old Trevor Ariza or 87-year-old wheelchair-bound Andre Iguodala out there if we get to the playoffs and both of those guys are suddenly looking spry, alive, and ready to make one last run. They were one day from retirement, Carl.
that's my favorite Nets metaphors, like the heist crew that gets together. So yeah, I think Dragic, Depot, Robinson, Jimmy, and Bam was what I wrote down. I think for this series, you know, the Nets are probably well served staying smaller. I think this would be the series if you're going to see one where you'd get Blake Griffin at the 5 minutes. Potentially, just because, you know, I don't necessarily know that he could hang with Bam, but I think that could make some sense. I think Jeff Green did Bam had big games against the Nets in those two earlier season games, but
he killed us.
I feel like, but he did, but the Nets, I feel like, you know, well, I mean, I feel like they won those games pretty handily, and I think I don't mind Jeff Green drawing that assignment. I don't necessarily think that he's going to slow them down or stop them, but I don't hate that matchup. You know, the Heat are scary just in the sense of like the run that they went on last year. And, you know, Jimmy Butler's crazy, and if he kind of elevates to that level again, you know, excuse me, that could potentially be a concern. But all in all, I feel like the Nets have good counters for this, particularly if you want to start throwing, you know, Aldridge in there to, you know, score in the paint, maybe against Bam, or maybe start throwing like Claxton in there to shut down some of their guard penetration, you know, switching off guys.
Yep. I'm trying to think if there's anybody else they would potentially throw out there at the end of games. I really don't see it. I think that somebody would probably have to get injured for them to do that. But it's just something, I think that they're very similar to the Celtics in that they made such a deep run last year that I don't think that they've cared much at all about the regular season. And if Victor Oladipo comes back, you've got Eric Spoelstra, you've got Jimmy Butler, you've got Bam Adebayo with another year under his belt of development, you've got Goran Dragic back and fully healthy. They could be a sleeping giant again, so I don't want to discount them, but it's going to be super interesting to see where they fall in the playoffs and what they look like at their best iteration. And I'll talk about where I rank these guys and how scared I truly am of them at the end. But I think this is pretty, we're going through the consensus right now. And I think this is what most people would agree with. Do you want to do the Bucks, or do you want me to go through my lineup?
Why don't you go first with the Bucks?
All right. Okay. Let's go wild. It's going to pain me and Nets fans not to include Brooke Lopez, one of the most all-time beloved Nets, in the closing lineup of the 2021 Milwaukee Bucks. But I'm going to have to do it. This is making a big assumption that PJ Tucker does have something left. We haven't seen much of him with the Bucks, but he looked okay with the Houston Rockets, even though he's got a lot of mileage on that body, and he plays hard every game when he's out there. He's just one of those guys that can't turn it off, kind of like Kevin Garnett. But I would have my Bucks closing lineup against the Nets as switchy, as stretchy, as shooty as possible with Drew. Good thing we didn't go all in on him and went in on James Harden. I'd much rather trade that package for Harden than Holiday. Dante, how the heck did I make this lineup? DiVincenzo. Chris, why do I spell my name like this? Middleton. Giannis, I should probably get a third MVP, but people are a little bit fatigued and they're not going to vote for me. And Jokic is playing great. Antetokounmpo. God, I feel bad for those announcers. And then our boy PJ. So that's what I'm thinking as a closing lineup. But I think there could be some cases for some other people in there.
Brett, we once again have the exact same lineup written down. So I also thought in the first matchup, like I was really impressed with DiVincenzo's defense in general. I thought the Bucks did a good job just really getting up in the Nets, past the 3-point line and kind of harassing them overall. I think in general, my fear with the Bucks is just that everybody kind of has written them off somewhat because of the playoff challenges that they've had the past couple of years. You know, part of that is like, oh, they adhere to their system too much and they need to change things up. And so, you know, they should use the regular season, you know, to experiment more. And this season they've been experimenting more. And I feel like people are like, yeah, the Bucks aren't even as good as they were, you know, previous years when they were blowing the doors off the regular season. So I'm a little bit worried that we're falling into our own trap a little bit. I also feel like, you mentioned the Giannis MVP case. Like, I don't necessarily think he should be, but I do feel like it's a little bit surprising to me that everybody, like, he's just sort of written out because people just assume that there's going to be voter fatigue. I feel like that's the sort of the same thing happening to the Bucks in general, which is like, you know, we've seen this before. Like, do we really trust it? Do we really want to, be concerned about it? Even though I think Drew Holiday's pretty different type of player for them, you know, particularly defensively. I think this team in Philly, the reason that they're scary is they theoretically have the guys to match up defensively, right? I mean, if you've got Holiday on Kyrie, you've got Giannis on KD, and you've got Middleton on who's the other guy? James Harden. A little guy named James Harden. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, the third guy, the big three. Whatever.
You know, you got Middleton on him, you've got PJ Tucker, you know, and then DiVincenzo on, let's say, Jeff Green and Joe Harris. Like, that's a pretty solid, like, 1-5 defensive foils all the way around. Like, the Bucks were, I mean, the Nets were still able to, you know, score against them in that first meeting. So that's not for nothing. I always sort of feel like Giannis gets a little bit tougher whistle in the playoffs than he does in the regular season. And that is a little bit a part of the sort of playoff kryptonite story for them. I don't know if that would continue or not. And I don't know if the Nets really have the guys to be physical with him in that way, aside from maybe DeAndre Jordan. So it'll be interesting to see. I think the big question for the Nets in that series is, do you play DeAndre Jordan to sort of play the drop coverage and form a wall against Giannis? Or do you, you know, how do you want to counter that? Do you want to throw Nick Claxton out there, who's probably the guy that could like stick with him the best of anybody? But, you know, I could also see him getting tossed around a little bit, just Giannis being so much, you know, sort of brute strength. Do you throw sort of Aldridge and DeAndre in there as like drop guys? Do you throw like a Jeff Green at him? Like how would you handle that problem?
I almost think you handle it similar to how you would handle the Joel Embiid issue, where you just assume that Giannis is going to get his. You treat him like Shaq and you let him get his, and you try to guard the other guys and hope that you can prevent them from getting super hot from three. Because I think if Giannis scores 75 points a game, but you shut down everybody else, you're still going to win those games. And if you don't double Giannis and you make him take the ball to the hole every single offensive possession, that's also going to tire him out on defense too. So I think that would probably be my strategy. It wouldn't be to focus our defense around Giannis, but rather, okay, cool, let the Bucks know, hey, if you guys want to run everything through Giannis and let him be the dude, okay, let him be the dude. We're cool with him taking 42 shots by the fourth quarter, being completely exhausted, and you guys having to rely on Jrue Holiday, Chris Middleton pick and roll.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think there's also something to, you know, doing that and I think I guess the way I'd say it is like the freedom that gives you as well is you can vary up the way that you're running guys at him too.
Yes. Right? Exactly. You can run anybody at him. Yeah.
And you can a little bit be, you know, Ulysses Grant in the Civil War and like just recognize that you have six bodies to their one and, you know, just chum them out there. Like, you know, let DeAndre Jordan pick up six fouls and let Nick Claxton get bodied around a little bit and let Jeff Green be too short and, you know, just let Bruce Brown take a couple whacks in there. Like, why not? So I don't hate that as in terms of a overall strategy.
I was going to say that I think it's going to be very telling. What's going to happen is the Nets are going to do everything in their power to try to keep whomever they believe should be in that closing lineup against the Bucks out of foul trouble and fully rested for those last 5 minutes. So we'll be able to tell as the game is going on, oh, it looks like they're intentionally leaving Jeff Green out of this key stretch of the game so he can be in the last 5 minutes. Or, hey, Clax hasn't played a ton in this third quarter. Maybe he's the guy that they want to go with. Or LaMarcus Aldridge, like, yeah, they didn't start him and he's played 5 minutes, but he's been in the game and he's warm. Maybe he's the guy they want to close with. So it's going to be interesting to watch that little chess match in the game and try to figure out who Steve Nash has decided on as our closing five or closing guy that he wants out there for the Giannis matchup and what type of defensive coverage we're going to have to run because of that.
Yeah. I also think, you know, trying to involve him on defense as much as you can, like directly in the action, as opposed to letting him be a weak side help defender, it is also a good strategy there too. I mean, I think that's where, like, even if you don't want LaMarcus Aldridge closing games, which I don't think I would against the Bucks, I think like throwing him out there for stretches early and just letting him bang around in the post and, you know, get some of that, like, you know, just get physical in that way. Put those miles on the odometer and then, you know, finish with somebody else, I think is an interesting strategy too. I guess the counter that the Bucks have for something like that is just throwing Lopez out there to try to shut that kind of stuff down and playing him a little bit more. So that's interesting too.
Right. And theoretically right now, Lopez is a better version of both LaMarcus Aldridge and DeAndre Jordan. Theoretically.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he's probably slightly less effective offensively than LaMarcus, but probably but better defensively, arguably, than both. So, yeah. All right. Any other Bucks thoughts before we?
I don't think so. I just don't want to be eating my words against Brook Lopez if the Nets decide to rely on drop coverage.
That would be kind of hilarious if
it would be. If we're going to go down and we go down to Brook Lopez, I make my peace with that. All right, the 76ers are probably the least exciting team outside of the Celtics to decide on the closing lineup for. But any wrinkles with them that you want to throw out there?
Who did you have? Because I think that they were actually sort of a hard one for me.
Well, so the reason they were so easy for me is right now their starting lineup out of any 5-man unit in the league has the absolute best net rating. Absolute best net rating. Now, the case could be made to play offense defense with Seth Curry and with George Hill. So that's what I was trying to figure out. Like, do we throw George Hill in that lineup? Because he can still stretch the floor, hit threes. He's not as quick of a shooter. He's not as much of a gravity guy as Seth Curry. I don't think he disrupts offenses as much, but what he brings on defense and the fact that he doesn't take that much off the table on offense, I think you can make the case to put him out there. That was the only potential wrinkle that I saw, but I wasn't sure if you saw anything else.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was thinking. Was, you know, and just to be clear, that starting lineup that you are talking about is Seth Curry, Danny Green, Tobias Harris, Ben Simmons, and Joel Embiid. Possibly. So the other thing with Hill too is, like, I think you get a little bit more playmaking out of him as well. So yeah. I feel like that plus the defense is interesting. The other interesting thing with Philly, and I think you saw it in this game a little bit. I mean, I struggle to take too much away from this game in general just because it was a little bit wacky. So first of all, Nets counters, Alize Johnson, good night and have a pleasant tomorrow. In terms of sort of, I think, the way that it's going to go for Philly, like, I think particularly as you get deeper into that series, they're going to ratchet up the defensive pressure that they're putting on the Nets, like, pretty significantly. I think it's going to be like I kind of likened it to those Giants team, like when the Giants beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl and the Patriots were 16-0, and it was just all about, like, constantly pressuring Brady, like, constantly hitting him. Like, I think you're going to see that in terms of just picking up at half court, blitzing the ball handler, like making the Nets make tough passes. I think, you know, that's where, like, Matisse Thybulle can come in, even though, you know, I don't think he'll be in closing lineups necessarily, but I think him coming in against the bench, like, because I feel like you sort of have to start looking at it as like pick sixes, right? Because the mm-hmm. turnovers are one of the few things that has been able to slow the Nets offense down fairly reliably over the course of the season. You know, if they're turning the ball over, like, you know, you just don't have, like, because you can't really force them into bad shots because they have so many good shooters and the shooters are so good, and you have to deal with so many different, like, guarding so many different people, that's sort of a loser's way to go about, like that's a fool's errand a little bit, right? You know, because at the end of the day, like, even if you press them to the end of the shot clock, like, Kevin Durant can pull up and hit a shot in your face. Kyrie Irving can pull up and hit a shot in your face. Harden can do stuff like that too. You know, Harris and Green can hit big shots, but turning them over, you know, A, is stopping that possession before it gets to that point. And B, you know, I think it has a positive effect on your offense going the other way because, you know, you're able to get fast breaks and you're able to get out in transition, which is going to be tougher, you know, for the Nets, particularly, you know, just the fact that they're not that great of a defensive team in the first place. And I think they're a better half-court defensive team than they are a transition defensive team. So,
yes.
That I think is a decent, you know, recipe for success on Philly's side. That's what I fear, you know, with that, like I've kind of made peace, like you talked about with just the fact that, like, Embiid's going to get his points, right? To me, the key is, you know, trying to throttle Tobias Harris a little bit more than they were able to do tonight. And, you know, having Ben Simmons kind of aimlessly drift in and out of the game like he did tonight as well, where, you know, he just, you know, he's going to make an impact on defense. I'll certainly give him that tip the cap, but, like, kind of keeping him out of transition and not having the offensive impact that he's capable of having. I think those are kind of your two X factors.
I think you're right. Turnovers are going to be very key for the Nets. And I was very surprised by the pace at which the 76ers play. They're in the top 10 of the league, and I would have considered them more of a half-court team. But when you look at their lineup and their roster outside of Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons is best suited offensively as a transition player, whether he's playmaking or he's finishing. And guys like Seth Curry and Danny Green and even Tobias Harris, who probably is their best ball handler in the half court offense when the game is on the line, does well in transition too. So it's interesting that they try to worship both gods, so to speak, where, hey, listen, Joel Embiid is one of the best post-up, isolation, half-court offensive creators in the league. But that being said, the rest of our team is fairly well positioned to run and gun off of turnovers, so they can beat you in both ways. And I think that's what makes that lineup so versatile and so scary. And if we're going to play the whole Joel Embiid get his and don't let the other guys beat us game, you hit the nail on the head. We cannot turn the ball over, because that's where we're really going to put the Sixers in a position to compete with us in the half court and then run us out of the gym in the transition offense.
Yeah, I think the other thing matchup wise just to consider, and I think you saw it a little bit tonight, although obviously the Nets were super shorthanded, is just like there's the size of Embiid. And that's its own sort of thing to contend with from a matchup perspective. But the Sixers are just huge all the way across the board. And I feel like you saw that with, you know, Joe Harris trying to guard Tobias Harris tonight. You know, Tobias Harris is they're actually fairly similar in terms of, like, Tobias Harris maybe an inch taller, but much longer wingspan, you know, and plays just much bigger and can take it down the post. You've got Ben Simmons, who's like 6'10 and sort of playing point guard. You've got, you know, Danny Green is pretty big as a wing. You know, if Curry's in there, I mean, that would be another sort of thing for the George Hill, you know, in for Curry kind of thing. You know, what am I talking about? So like substituting George Hill in for Curry in that lineup, just then you're sort of big across the board. The Nets, I think, like we said, sort of when the chips are down, are going to want to play smaller. They're going to want to play Jeff Green at center. And I just, you know, I feel like this is a team that doesn't really need to make an adjustment to be able to sort of annihilate you on the boards and just be big inside in a way that most of the other opponents that they're facing kind of aren't necessarily.
Right. That's a good point. You don't necessarily need to be the best defender in the world, but if you're big and long, you can alter those shots. You don't even need to keep up with the Nets players. That's going to be such an interesting series to watch. Okay. Well,
and we've seen zero games with the teams at full strength as well, like during the season. So
right, we have no true empirical data, and you know maybe we'll get some down the stretch if these games start to be meaningful. But I think the teams are going to continue to play it safe because it really doesn't matter. And if you go all out in a regular season game and one of your key guys gets injured, then I mean that's it right there. So you can't afford to do that. So given all of this, do you want to ask me the question, or do you want me to ask you the question? Because I want to ask you who you're most scared of and why. And feel free to turn it back on me.
I think I'm most scared of Philly, more so than Milwaukee. But it's definitely one of the two of them. Hmm. I think I'm scared of Philly just because it's such a contrast of styles between Philly and the Nets. I think that I'm honestly less scared. I mean, even though Philly won, like I'm a little bit less scared of them after tonight's game, but it's kind of stupid. I think just because it's such a contrast of styles, and because specifically, like I talked about, like the Nets, like one of the weaknesses that they do have on offense is turning the ball over. It's something that like KD specifically has struggled with. And it's something that I think you can, you know, they as a team are going to need to dribble quite a bit. So it's something that you can do against them. And I think a lot of the games where we've seen them play down to their competition, that's been the reason for it. And so Philly being so good at turning other teams over, you know, just like looking at how many sort of steals and loose balls they created off of like back taps today, you know, that worries me. That is a path, I think, to victory that Philly is sort of uniquely adept at, or a weakness, I guess, that the Nets have that Philly is maybe uniquely adept at exploiting in a way that Milwaukee isn't. I think there's a little bit of a depth concern, but I don't know. I just love the matchup because of the contrast of styles, right? Like, I love how deep the Nets can go, how many guys you can bring in that are, you know, such high IQ offensive players. But I love how deep that Philly can go in terms of just defensive goons that you can bring in off the bench.
I love the goon factor in any Nets Sixers series. If you've got Mike Scott, Blake Griffin, Joel Embiid, Ben Simmons. I mean, these are just wild personalities that were thrown out.
Don't forget Bruce Brown.
Bows. Yeah, don't forget Bruce Brown. Bruce Brown's going to be hitting 1-3 all series. John at the bench. I cannot wait for that one corner three that he's going to hit. I mean, it's going to be awesome. And like, if Kyrie gets in his feelings one game, Durant never shies away from talking trash. I mean, this could be like the all-time trash talk series if you think about it. So I am hoping that we get it. I tried to put together some sort of sound process when I was figuring out who I was most scared of. I don't know if I landed on an answer, but I do think this is an interesting thought exercise. So let's think about it this way. The league right now is faster paced and more efficient than it's ever been. And I think the Nets are an incredible amalgamation of that. They're an incredibly efficient offense, even though they're not the top ranked offense in the league. I think that most people would agree that with everybody at full strength, we're going to be head and shoulders above any other team in the league. Meaning that if you play a high-paced game, there are a lot of possessions. 99 times out of 100, the Nets are probably going to win a game because of that offense. So when you're looking at teams that could theoretically beat the Nets, it's a lot tougher to find a team that could out-offense the Nets. But it is a little bit easier to see if you squint a team slowing down the game, limiting offensive possessions, and then still finding a way to execute enough in the half court and turn the Nets over enough to compete with them. So those are the type of teams that I was trying to figure out when I was looking at who I was most scared of. Some interesting things that I came up with. If you look at pace of the teams that we're talking about, the Heat are in the bottom two of the league right now in terms of overall pace, and both the Celtics and the Hawks round out the bottom 10. So it is interesting that the Heat and the Celtics could grind the game to a halt pace-wise if they wanted to and still score efficiently and have a positive net rating. So those are a couple of two things that I thought were interesting. And if you're looking at best coach among those teams, I think it's far and away. Spoelstra could make a case for Stevens. I just don't think he has the weapons at his disposal. So those are a couple of factors I was taking into account when I was going through this. I still think I settled on what you did, which is I am most scared of the 76ers because in the playoffs, you shrink down your rotation, you play your best lineups and you run them into the ground and you don't care about injuries. You don't care about anything else. It's just all about execution. And if the 76ers do that, like I said, they have the best five-man lineup of any team in the league right now, and you could throw George Hill in there, and there's a bunch of goons, so it's tough for me to choose any team but them as our biggest opponent. But this did, I was already thinking of the Bucks as a sleeping giant. This did make me think twice about both the Heat and the Celtics and their ability to slow the game down, execute in the half court, and still win games. I think they could theoretically throw the same type of formula out there as the 76ers, where if they do turn the ball over or turn the Nets over and get out in transition and execute in the half court, they could keep some of those games close. But I would still put the 76ers first, and then Bucks, Heat, Celtics. This isn't anything revolutionary, although I still feel like we're kind of sleeping on how good these teams could be if they ratchet up in the playoffs.
Yeah, I think specifically Milwaukee too. I'm doing the exact same thing as you, right? I'm, you know, banging the drum for like, I think we're all sleeping on them. I think we're all underestimating them. And then like, I'm going to go and say that like, they don't scare me as much as Philly, and Philly doesn't scare me that much. So it's interesting. Like, you know, on the one hand, I think you could kind of make the claim, and I've kind of heard myself do it, that sort of nobody can beat the Nets except for the Nets. But I think that there are teams that can sort of assist the Nets in beating themselves, right, in the sense of like, you know, forcing turnovers and you know, forcing things to not work. I think
that's the thing. Aldridge, I think turnovers is huge.
I do too. I think it is the clear path. I think with Aldridge, like, I'm a little bit less worried about the sort of 2015 Cavs, like, approach to the Warrior. I mean, I guess they kind of always did it, but like that first year when the Cavs and Warriors played, when the Warriors won and Kyrie was hurt for a couple games and Kevin Love was out, and it was just literally like LeBron and Tristan Thompson just like grinding the game to a halt, like, you know, playing like they were Wisconsin basketball, putting the bottom back in the peach basket and just like, you know, pounding the offensive glass. Like, you know, I feel like with Aldridge and to a lesser extent Jordan, like that's not really that viable against Brooklyn, Griffin as well. So I feel like there's enough of a counter there to prevent that. Tristan Thompson like would be the guy I would want to do that with. So, you know, that's intriguing from Boston's standpoint, you know, particularly with some more weaponry around him. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Ultimately, like, I still feel a little bit, I mean, this was such a, you know, a fun game turned into such a fun game in the fourth quarter, but I still feel a little bit disappointed that we didn't get a true test of these two teams at, you know, something resembling full strength at any point this season. But I guess we'll save for the playoffs, Brett.
Hey, me too. Rose-colored glasses, though. This is classic Greg Popovich. You throw your bench players, your fringe guys out there in high-pressure situations. They get enough of those in the regular season. They take their punches. It builds their confidence, and they're ready if and when they need to step up in the playoffs, which all of these guys will probably have a moment. Look at the difference in confidence and role and demeanor that Landry Shamet has between the beginning of the regular season and now. I'm hoping that's happening for all of our players. So that is the silver lining to all of this. That being said, you know, our best lineup probably has to play together a few times before the end of the season to be ready.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, they do and they don't. I mean, I don't know. I sort of don't feel like adding Harden back in is going to make things worse or make things, you know, more difficult. I'm less worried about that fit just because of the way that they looked against the Clippers and a couple other games. But I don't know. We'll see. It's interesting that they haven't played together. And defensively, I do think that there'll be a little bit of a fit thing. So we'll see how that goes. And hopefully they have a couple first round series to adjust there. But we are closing in on 90 minutes, I think, here. So we should probably wrap her up.
Yeah. Worst part is I have more stuff to say, too. So let's definitely wrap it up. That's the first cue. Yeah.
Please go along. Continue. We could always chop it into two episodes.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I mean, really, the only thing that I was thinking is it's not necessarily that I'm worried about throwing our best lineup out there and it not looking good. It's just more about those little things that, oh wow, like if I do this when he does that in this type of situation, that's something that we can use. Or wow, I just did that. Like we should keep it in our back pocket and use that. Like those little connective tissue things that can really only be formed by playing together, they're going to miss out on. Do I think that's going to cost us a shot at a championship? No. Do I think it's going to prevent that lineup from being the best offensive lineup in the league? No. But I do think that stuff is like it. There's some things that can only be developed when you're playing in pressure situations on the court together. And like you and I say, when we're podcasting, save it for the air. And that was your phrase, so I'm not going to steal that from you. But that the same thing with the Nets. Like they have to save it for the court and really figure out and like find that magic and secret ingredient. And they're not going to find that if they don't play together.
I think that was like Chris Milholland's phrase. I don't think I created that.
Was that Milholland? Dude, we got to shout out Milholland. We should shout him out every pod.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he's on, you know, getting his tweets on TNT and everything.
I feel like somebody interviewed. No, that was Brooks. Never mind. Brooks interviewed Jamal Crawford recently with Stern. Pretty cool.
Oh, that's awesome. That's cool. So yeah, we should bring this bad boy home, Brett.
Grab it. Let's take the plane home. Listen to us on literally just Google the word podcast, put the word app next to podcast and look us up. We're probably going to be on there. Anchor that we record all this stuff on pumps it out for us. It's awesome. Stitcher, Breaker, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. I always forget some of the other major platforms, but we're on there. We appreciate you guys listening. If anybody has stayed with us throughout 90 minutes of this podcast, we don't have any merch, but hit us up. If we ever do, you're getting some free merch.
Pocket Casts, Uncle Cracker, I don't know, others. Yeah, free merch. Once I'll send you a T-shirt. We'll write on it in Sharpie. It'll be great.
We'll send you a James Harden crotch mask.
Absolutely. RussellandFro@gmail.com. At RussellandFro on Twitter.
Bye.
That's right back.